Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, August 26th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, concerns over emergency housing allowance impacting Garberville. Humboldt's 4th District Supervisor on Sheriff's Oversight Committee, Industrial Projects, and the Future of Economic Development. And as California workers seek higher wages, a program seeks to help them. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The North Coast saw record-breaking rain this weekend, with Friday marked as the fourth rainiest day in August history. However, temperatures in the hundreds are expected to return inland by midweek.
Hi, everybody. This is Zahaira Velez. I'm a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, Eureka. This past weekend, we had a storm that brought beneficial rainfall across the area. We got new records for last Friday, for August 24, for Eureka and Crescent City Airport. So we got, for the Woodley Island, we got 1.19 inches. So this, smashed the previous record of 0.2700 inches that was set in 1997. And for Crescent City Airport, we got, a lot of rain, 2.05 inches. That, as I mentioned, that smashed the previous record of 1,200 set in 1975. So, yeah, we got a lot of rain for August.
She explained that it was an unusual event, but not unheard of.
If we look back to the old-time old records, we have other days in August for previous years that was wetter than this one. But this last Friday, as I mentioned, was an unusual rainy day for August. And this one goes down as the fourth rainiest day in August for Eureka area and also for Crescent City. So it was a really good day for rainy and beneficial across the area.
This weekend's rain assisted firefighters in northeastern Humboldt, where the Boise Fire has grown to nearly 13,000 acres. The rain helped to increase containment to over 40%. But drier and warmer weather is expected to return to the area. However, with the recent moisture, no significant fire movement is anticipated. This week, areas like Garberville, Covelo, and Hoopa could see temperatures nearing 100 degrees or higher.
Currently, we have a high pressure over the area, so we are having drier air and warming trend temperature through at least Thursday expected. For the interior area, we are expecting mid-90s up to 100s possible. For the rest of this week. And also we are going to see even near the coast warming up with temperature possible in the 70s, mainly for the tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday is possible. We are going to have also an increasing of the winds along the coast. It will be a little bit breezy by tomorrow afternoon, evening as well for the coastal areas. Later in the evening into Wednesday, offshore flow will increase, and this will yield clear skies along much of the coastal area late Tuesday and Wednesday, as I mentioned. So it will be warmer even along the coast for Wednesday, as I mentioned, with temperatures in the 70s for the coastal areas and 90s into 100 for the interior valleys.
Although temperatures will be perfect for enjoying the coast, a hazardous seas warning is in place until Wednesday.
Right. Yes, we're having right now small craft condition in the southern outer water. Winds will continue increasing toward Tuesday. with the pressure gradient tightening. So yeah, it will be hazardous condition for small craft for Tuesday in the offshore waters, and by the late in the afternoon, evening, the strongest winds are expected over the across the outer waters. So this is expected to drive in some small craft wave or single wave that can make hazardous conditions for the inner waters from Point San George to Cayman Docino by Tuesday afternoon through Wednesday morning, if possible. So, yeah, it will be a little bit choppy, the water, with this strongest winds offshore.
For an up-to-the-minute weather forecast, you can visit weather.gov/EKA. Downtown Garberville is one of the areas of Humboldt County where emergency housing will be allowed without public comment. And Southern Humboldt Supervisor Michelle Bushnell is concerned about its impacts. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County supervisors have approved ordinances allowing tiny house and emergency housing villages, but Southern Humboldt Supervisor is concerned about the ability to create them without public review in areas like downtown Garberville. Approved at the August 20th Board of Supervisors meeting, the ordinances create approval pathways for tiny house villages and emergency housing, sometimes without public notification and comment. Both housing types are principally permitted or allowed by right in some residential and commercial zones. Unlike with tiny housing, units in emergency housing villages don't have to meet code requirements and are allowed only when a shelter crisis is declared. As with tiny houses, the emergency housing units are principally permitted in community commercial zones. That's the zoning that covers downtown Garberville, and Southern Humboldt Supervisor Michelle Bushnell flagged it as a concern.
I am very supportive of this, and it's very much needed, and it's very much needed in you know, like Southern Humboldt area, which is already, there is one going, there's a grant that's been recognized down there. I have some angst about downtown Main Street having no public input. If it goes next to a business or, it's not that I don't think that it should be there. I just think that there should be a process where public input could happen. And I think that the pushback could be large if this were to happen in downtown Main Street. And I don't know what to do about that, but you know, it's residential on the back sides and commercial on the front sides. And it just seems a little odd to not have the public input.
In this exchange with Bushnell, Planning Director John Ford said impacts have been considered, but the emergency housing is geared for homeless people, and public review would likely stop their development.
I will say that that was not something that we didn't think about.
Did or did not?
We did think about it, absolutely did think about it. The trade-off when you're trying to create housing is that many times there are those who would object to that housing. And so if you allow public input, it can become a very painful process that actually discourages people from even beginning that process, knowing that it could result in many hearings and appeals and it may not get built because of public opinion.
I do understand that, but if you create those housing opportunities in a community and then you have no commercial in that community to put those people to work, what are you creating?
I understand that I don't ever want to be argumentative, but the struggle that we were having is one of the comments by the public was made, it needs to be available throughout the county. And so where can these things realistically be put that are close to services, close to transit, and those are in the higher density residential and commercial zones within the community plan areas.
During a public comment period, longtime housing advocate Nezzy Wade said the range of locations where the new alternative housing can be allowed needs to be expanded.
What I'm seeing in a lot of this is a very expensive institutional model that might be hard for all communities, especially remote communities in Humboldt, to be able to achieve this. It needs accessibility and affordability have to drive this one if we're actually really going to be able to implement this for on a broad basis. I see the area of the maps being pretty limited in where this can happen, and I don't know why it's so limited, but certainly communities everywhere need to be able to have the opportunity to support their own in a way that is local. And I think this is one of the options that may be able to happen under those circumstances.
Despite her concerns, Bushnell joined a unanimous vote to approve the ordinances. According to a staff report, there are 922 parcels in the county where tiny house villages are allowed. Zones where public review is required include commercial, industrial, and mixed-use rural. Public review is also required for emergency housing in those zones, as well as some industrial zones and zones considered unclassified. There are about 700 parcels in the county open to emergency housing villages. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
KMUD News is excited to announce a new segment on our nightly newscast, a monthly check-in with Humboldt County supervisors. This segment will provide our listeners with up-to-date information directly from their elected representatives. Tonight's monthly check-in features Humboldt's 4th District Supervisor, Natalie Arroyo, representing the unincorporated areas of Eureka, Fairhaven, and Samoa. Good afternoon, Supervisor Arroyo, and thank you for being the first Humboldt supervisor to join us for our monthly check-in. I want to start by passing the mic, giving you the opportunity to start the conversation with an update and overview.
Yeah, so I have, of course, been doing, all of us on the board have a lot of assignments to different boards and commissions. We actually, when we're elected to a position like the County Board of Supervisors, we end up being assigned to a bunch of different government agency boards too. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things that are happening there and then tell you some of the other things I've been working on my own that are sort of passion projects within my district. So some of the boards that I serve on are the Redwood Coast Energy Authorities. So we help to, do renewable energy projects. We do sell power to customers and we're able to invest in more renewable forms of energy. There's a lot going on with RCEA these days. And so I encourage folks to check us out, and I'd be happy to give some updates about energy because that's definitely on the forefront of people's minds with the offshore wind projects and a lot of our transmission needs and connectivity needs all over the county. Another board I serve on that has our meeting tonight is the Redwood Region Economic Development Commission. We make loans to small businesses that can't, for whatever reason, get loans through traditional banks. And so that's a really cool and important community resource. So those are a couple ones that are, really current right now. And I just wanted to touch on the county side, we've gone through our full budgeting process and we're, really in a period of restraint with the budget, which is really, I think challenging for our employees and our community. But we are doing our best to be really responsible with the resources we have. So we're going through a period of a bit more restraint and really taking a hard look at everything that we're doing and making sure that it's necessary and achieving our community's goals. So that's something that, I think we're deep in the middle of. We have put a measure on the ballot for an increase related to emergency response and transportation. So some folks will have heard about that. That will really work on a lot of our transportation corridors throughout the county, especially in our more rural areas where county roads are the main road network. Some of the things that I've been working on personally are I'm really digging into the issue of medical provider recruitment and retention in our community. I'm sure you've heard that, there's several local facilities that are changing or closing. And one of the things that comes up so frequently in my district is, access to medical care, but I think that's pretty universal. And I'm really doing a series of in-depth interviews to understand why that is and what's being done about it. And it's been really, really helpful, honestly. So I'll be doing a community meeting later this year or early in 2025 to have a panel of experts talk about that and to share all of what I've learned through all of my interviews.
We will continue to follow up on those topics into the fall. But another committee you'll be sitting on is an ad hoc looking into the formation of a sheriff's oversight committee. Humboldt Sheriff William Hansel is not fond of this idea, and I know you've explained that it's not a punitive action. I believe you'll be working on this committee with Supervisor Bushnell. So can you speak to what the goals and role the committee will be playing in local policing?
So I'll be sitting down with Supervisor Bushnell, and we'll be meeting with the sheriff and the district attorney and others as we seek to gather information about this. There was an assembly bill in 2020 that passed that allowed for boards of supervisors or the voters to establish an oversight committee over sheriff's offices. And so one thing that, I've been highlighting is that, this could be passed by the voters. Of course, some, voter group would have to take, citizen group would have to take the initiative to put it on the ballot. But that is something that could happen separate from the Board of Supervisors. But if we really take a proactive stance of figuring out, how this would work effectively, what other counties have done, there's many, many, many counties that have done this or are in the process of doing it, and I've talked to quite a few of them. I think that would be really helpful to go into it with our eyes wide open and to, kind of create a structure that would work for Humboldt County and would work for our sheriff's office. Right now, there is an investigation process and a complaint process, as well as internal investigations. So I'm well aware that there are a lot of processes, and maybe our community also just doesn't know about what those are or how to ask for what they need from as far as in, publicly available information. And some information will never be able to be made public, but I think we should, aim to be as transparent as we can. So we're going to have those conversations in our ad hoc and report back within just the next couple of months. So people will be hearing back about this before the end of October. We have a deadline from the grand jury because this is associated with a grand jury report. And we'll be reporting back before then.
We will definitely follow up on that as well. In other news, there are major projects slated for areas in and around your district in regards to offshore wind and the fish farm. Any updates on that front?
Well, at our Redwood Region Economic Development Commission meeting tonight, our special presenter is Scott from Nordic Aquafarms. So he's one of the local reps for the project. And so that will actually be the my most current update I'll be receiving tonight. I haven't checked in with him in the last month or so. So and I think they're moving quickly. One of the things that I understand they need to move forward with is the Harbor District is their landlord essentially, and they need to work on some demolition at the site of the old pulp mill. The tower, the smokestack needs to be removed and some other items. So I think we'll get a lot of info tonight. And so that's continuing to move forward. They've gotten most of the permits in hand that they need for Nordic Aquafarms to proceed. And again, they are planning to have kingfish, which are, not a locally available species, and a fish that's, really popular in the sushi market. So there's this sense that they won't be competing directly with local fishermen and our local fishing community. With the offshore wind, I had the privilege of meeting with Senator Padilla's staff when they were in town recently, touring the Harbor District and learning about the project. And, he's our one of our two senators in Washington representing California. So it was great to make a connection with his staff. And that is, the project that the Harbor District is working on for the port facility is within my district. And it's moving ahead, although they still need to leverage some of that public funding with private investment. And so they're going out to see who their partner is going to be and going out through a request process to see who, might propose on that. So that's kind of an exciting and new time, as we heard a few months ago. Crowley, one of their business partners, decided, that their partnership would look different and that they wouldn't be their primary partner on the development of that site. But that gives them the opportunity to, kind of define it again and look for somebody new.
And my final question is in regards to a different Scott Adair, who recently left his post as the Director of Economic Development for the county. As you're well aware, we've seen a lot of changes in just the 8 years alone. So I'm wondering if you have insight into who might fill that position and what strategic goals the supervisors would like to set for them.
Yeah, so we're in the process of an economic development strategic plan, essentially. We have a consultant working closely with our staff on that. And that's, you know, a document and a product that while Scott was really championing it, it doesn't rely entirely on him. So thankfully, that process is still going. And, you know, we're really going to look at that feedback from the community to determine what our priorities for investment and economic development should be as a county, along with our many partners that we work with to do economic development. Scott's leaving a really fantastic team of really skilled people who are continuing to work on economic development, but we haven't made a determination yet about how we'll fill that position and when. We're going to take a little bit of time to evaluate the team and the skills and what we need, and also, you know, kind of how that fits into our planning process. So I know that's not the most exciting answer, but I've been reminded recently of how important a good, strong plan is. I'm a planner in my background, and, a lot of times, with government processes, we follow the steps of our plan, and it seems like it's going slow at first, and then it really starts to pick up steam. So that's where we're at right now.
Any other final thoughts, Supervisor Arroyo?
Well, I just want to thank Scott Adair for his time with the county. He's done some really cool work, and we are sad to see him go, but he'll still be in the community, and just want to give a big shout out to him and appreciation for all his hard work.
Again, that was Humboldt County's 4th District Supervisor, Natalie Arroyo, who will be joining us on the fourth Monday of every month right here on KMUD's Local News. In state news, as California workers seek higher wages, a program seeks to help them move up. Suzanne Potter reports.
Unions representing fast food workers are asking the state's new fast food council to support a 70-cent per hour boost in the minimum wage at its next meeting on September 11th. The minimum wage for fast food workers was recently raised to $20 an hour, but that works out to just over $41,000 a year, which in California is significantly less than the average cost of living. Linda Becker with the nonprofit Merit America supports a higher minimum wage, but says that's just a start.
While raising the minimum wage offers an immediate paycheck boost for low-wage workers, it's just one piece of the puzzle. We still really firmly believe that a low-wage job should be a stepping stone and not a dead end.
Merit America offers intensive career counseling and online courses in IT support, data analytics, cybersecurity, project management, and UX design. It costs nothing to start and a maximum of $5,700 total. According to Forbes magazine, it costs on average more than $53,000 a year to cover housing, medical care, food, transportation, and taxes in California, the third highest cost of living in the country. Becker says learners only start to pay Merit America back at $95 a month after they get a higher paying job.
The average wage gain that we see is about $24,000 a year, which is significant, kind of life-changing increase of wages post-program.
California's general minimum wage is $16 an hour. Over the next few years, the state is also phasing in a higher minimum wage of $18 to $25 per hour for certain healthcare positions. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. suspended his campaign and endorsed Donald Trump. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
During his speech announcing his decision to step away from his presidential campaign, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said his internal polls had shown that his presence in the race would hurt Trump and help Democratic nominee Kamala Harris, though recent public polls don't provide a clear indication that he is having an outsized impact on support for either major party candidate. Kennedy spoke at length about his grievances with the Democratic Party, the news media, and political institutions, which he said had coordinated together to quash his campaign. He spoke for nearly 20 minutes before he said explicitly that he was, in fact, endorsing Trump.
Three great causes drove me to enter this race in the first place, primarily. And these are the principal causes that persuaded me to leave the Democratic Party and run as an independent. And now, to throw my support to President Trump, the causes were free speech, the war in Ukraine, and the war on our children.
Kennedy Jr. is the son of the late Attorney General and Senator Robert Kennedy and the nephew of President John F. Kennedy. He first entered the 2024 presidential race as a Democrat, but left the party last fall to run as an independent. He built an unusually strong base for a third-party candidate, fueled in part by anti-establishment voters and vaccine skeptics who have followed his anti-vaccine work since the COVID-19 pandemic. But he has since lost some of that popularity amid a number of controversies and minor scandals, and his campaign faced strained finances and mounting legal challenges. Recent polls put Kennedy's support in the mid-single digits, and it's unclear if he'd get even that in a general election. Kennedy said he is not ending his campaign, but only suspending it, and that while he would be removing himself from the ballots in 10 battleground states to avoid being a spoiler candidate, his name would stay on the ballot in states where one candidate or the other had a clear path to victory. He encouraged his supporters in those states to continue to vote for him. Kennedy said his decision to suspend his campaign followed a series of conversations he held with Trump over the past few weeks.
In a series of long, intense discussions, I was surprised to discover that we are aligned on many key issues. In those meetings, he suggested that we join forces as a unity party. We talked about Abraham Lincoln's team of rivals. That arrangement would allow us to disagree publicly and privately and fiercely, if need be, on issues over which we differ, while working together on the existential issues upon which we are in concordance.
Kennedy added that he had reached out to the Harris campaign to see if the vice president was interested in holding a similar conversation, but said he was rebuffed. A year ago, some would have thought it inconceivable that a member of arguably the most storied family in Democratic politics would work with Trump to keep a Democrat out of the White House. Even in recent months, Kennedy has accused Trump of betraying his followers, while Trump has criticized Kennedy as, quote, the most radical left candidate in the race. But shortly after Kennedy made his announcement, Trump spoke in Las Vegas and warmly thanked him for the endorsement.
We just had a very nice endorsement from RFK Jr., Bobby. And I'll be talking about that. We're heading out right after this. We're going to be going to Arizona. We'll be talking about that and a lot of other things, too. But I just want to thank everybody. And I want to thank Bobby. That was very nice. That was really very nice. That's big. He's a great guy, respected by everybody.
Five of Kennedy's family members issued a statement calling his support for Trump a, quote, sad ending to a sad story. In their statement, they reiterated their support for Harris. Kennedy's sister, Carrie Kennedy, posted the statement on X, formerly Twitter, which read in part, quote, "Our brother Bobby's decision to endorse Trump today is a betrayal of the values that our father and our family hold most dear." I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, and Scott Baba. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, related documents, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send us an email to news@kmod.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.